Good afternoon. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is October the 21st, 2021. And today it is my privilege, honor to introduce to you my guest, who is Professor Stephen Dean at Brooklyn Law School in, well, New York State. And many of you will know him by his Twitter handle, which is Brooklyn Tax Prof. That's Brooklyn Tax Prof. And I'm really excited to have him on the podcast today because he has a wealth of knowledge and is carving out, I think, a very important perspective on how various tax rules work generally and internationally, particularly, and even has some thoughts on the whole evolution of FATCA. So this should be great. Welcome, Stephen. How are you today?
I'm doing great, John. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to get to know you a little bit on Twitter, and it's been even better to see your face at least, and maybe one day we'll actually meet in person.
Absolutely, that would be great. Well, I want to repeat what I said in the introduction. I think you're doing some absolutely amazing work. And I would suggest that, in fact, I'm going to put some of your papers up, you know, links to the podcast after this. But, you know, I think that there's more evil that can be done in the world in tax codes than probably any other kind of legislation. And I wouldn't say that all parts of it are evil, but what I really like about your work is that you talk about sort of what I would call the sociology of tax. And, you know, some of what I would agree with you, or I think somewhat racist assumptions, okay, upon which some of these laws have been based for years and years. But anyway, let's sort of start with how does a person of your clearly enormous talents find your way into the world of tax?
So it was actually an accident. In college, I had ruled out law school, and I ended up working for economists. And the second year out of college, I worked for economists at KPMG. And I was doing transfer pricing with them. And some of your listeners will know what transfer pricing is, some of them won't. But it's essentially how you figure out how much tax a multinational will pay in any given jurisdiction. And those rules that I helped these economists, I mean, I was clearly just a data entry nobody. But I learned a little bit about these rules. And I learned two things, which surprised me very much. One, tax was interesting. And two, tax lawyers were the ones who, in this case, certainly, were running the show. I thought economists were at the top of the food chain in terms of understanding how the world worked. But it turns out that tax lawyers, in this case, were really in charge.
So you immediately went to law school?
Oh, 100%. 100%. So you can picture me wandering around the halls of Yale Law School. So the way they do it there, you have one semester of required courses, then your second semester of your first year, you take electives. And that year, international tax is being offered. And I begged the professor to allow me to take international tax at the same time as federal income tax, basic tax course. She, of course, said, go away, more politely than that. But I was really so excited to do tax, and none of my classmates understood it at all. They all thought I was a little bit crazy.
Well, it's, you know, international tax, enormously complex area. I mean, how did you find studying international? Actually, I think you could study international tax without having taken the first year tax course.
I think you probably could get away with it. But I think that I was afraid that I wouldn't get to take it because tax is not offered very much at Yale, but I was able to take it later on and I'm glad I waited. Not only did I have a wonderful professor when I took it, Sam Thompson, now at Penn State, but I knew I'd already taken corporate by that time. And the way Sam Thompson taught international, it had a lot of corporate in it. So taking it in that sequence was smart. But I agree, you could do a lot of international without having taken, certainly at the same time, take it at the same
time.
Well,
your background in transfer pricing must have given you a huge head start with that.
You know, I knew so little of the law. You know, when you're coming at it from the perspective of economists, I really didn't know much about the law. I understood some parts of it, but it really gave me more curiosity than insight into the way it works.
Mm-hmm. So let's, you know, I'd like to ask you some of your thoughts on, you know, what I find really interesting about your work is that it combines sort of the technical with, you know, with sort of what I call the sociology of tax. And, you know, based on, I've read a lot of your stuff, which is great, but it all comes back, it seems to me, the starting moment, the seminal moment seems to be the 2001 OECD threatening sanctions against tax havens. Was that kind of the right beginning for you?
That to me is the original sin, we might call it. And I think that a lot of the rules that your listeners are all too familiar with really can be traced to that that original sin. And when the OECD had been called on by the G20 in the late 90s to account for why international tax, certainly corporate tax, but also individual, was not working very well. And, they were being told to explain themselves, right? Explain why the system that you have been in charge of for decades doesn't seem to be working very well, allows corporate avoidance, individual evasion. What's happening? And it seemed to me that, I was very, very young at the time, just out of law school, that what they were talking about was really a cop-out. They were being asked a tough question and they came up with a really easy answer, but it was the wrong answer. They decided that what was happening was a fight between haves and have-nots, where the have-nots were getting away with something. So in 2000, when the OECD came up with its blacklist, so its approach was not a systemic reevaluation of what it was doing. It didn't say, okay, we're gonna give up on the arm's length method. We're gonna embrace formula apportionment, which many have been advocating for years as a better way to tax multinational income. They doubled down on the existing system. And they essentially came up with a blacklist of countries that they thought were the problem. And on that list were countries like Liberia, which were doing many things wrong, but being the source of the world's tax problems was not one of them. And not on that list were countries like Switzerland. So they came up with this list, this easy set of answers for why they hadn't been doing their job for many years. And it was at best misguided, and at worst, deeply cynical. And I honestly don't know which of the two it was. I knew it was easy for me to know that Liberia did not belong in this list, because I had happened to have around the same time, an asylum client. So I had an asylum client from Liberia who I spent many hours with. Learning his life story and why he ultimately was granted asylum in the United States after learning the persecution he endured from Charles Taylor, the war criminal who was in charge of Liberia at the time. And so it was easy for me to look at this list and see how ridiculous it was. And of course, the world learned, a few years later when all the scandal about the Swiss banking system broke, everybody saw that the omission of Switzerland was really outrageous, but for me, it was the inclusion of Liberia that really did was to me the original sin. And so many of the policies we've had since then have been the same kind of the same ilk as those that domestically produced mass incarceration that have contributed enormously to child poverty. There's a sense that everything would be fine if we were just tougher, right? We just need to be tougher on people, tougher on countries, and everything will work out fine. It's all about enforcement, not about fairness, unfortunately.
Enforcement of what, though?
It doesn't matter. That's part of the problem. What would sanctions on Liberia have achieved? Nothing, right? And what was... What was the OECD demanding that these jurisdictions do? They were demanding these jurisdictions engage in the kind of information exchange that, not the kind of information we have now with CRS. They were demanding the sort of old-fashioned tax return data on magnetic tapes in foreign languages.
Or shoebox of receipts. A shoebox of receipts.
Yes, that's exactly right, John. They were essentially demanding shoeboxes of receipts from these countries, which would have accomplished nothing. So it almost doesn't matter what you're enforcing as long as you look tough and look strong. And I think that, you know, when FATCA a decade later came out, it was a vast improvement over that, in that it might actually generate useful information, because it wasn't just a shoebox of information. It was very clear about the information that would be demanded, right? And it would be information that would, in theory, be useful, although who knows how it's used. But there was no sense of proportion. There was no sense that what we needed was to be fair. It was just clear to whoever created that, that America was being fleeced, and the way to fix that was to be tough. And right. And, you know, I don't know that America wasn't being fleeced, but I don't think that the solution to it was toughness. Like, you know, I went to religious school for elementary school. And so all the parables I know very well, and I reminded always of the story of the bet between the sun and the wind. I don't know if you know this one, but the parable goes that the sun and the wind were having a fight about who was the stronger one. And they both thought they were the stronger one. And the wind said, "Watch this, I'm the stronger one. I'm gonna blow the coat off of this farmer or sheep herder, whoever it is, somebody out in the country." And so he blew and blew on the shepherd. And no matter how hard he blew, the shepherd just hugged his coat tighter around it, and he couldn't do anything with it. And then the sun gave it a shot, and he shined down his warm rays on the shepherd, who of course took his coat off because he was warm. So the story, I don't know what my teachers wanted me to take away from that, but I hope it was that sometimes just being tough isn't going to accomplish anything. And I think that the lesson that FATCA took away from the failed exercise in 2000 was that targeting individual countries like Birria that are not part of the problem, and avoiding targeting countries like Switzerland that are a big part of the problem, is not okay. They also learned that asking for a shoebox of receipts is not helpful. But what they didn't learn, what they didn't take away from that, was that simply being tough is not always the right answer and is not always going to get you the result that you want. Sometimes a gentler approach might actually succeed better in the long run.
So I've noticed in your writing that you sort of transitioned from that to Treasury Secretary Neal's op-ed in the Washington Post.
Sure, Paul O'Neill, yep.
Yeah, Paul O'Neill, yeah. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and compare that to, in 2021, Secretary Yellen, which I think is a somewhat different approach, isn't it?
You know, it's very different, and it's really confusing. So, you know, in 2001, when Secretary O'Neill backed away from the OECD effort against a harmful tax competition and its blacklist, it did so partly at the urging of the U.S. Congressional Black Caucus. So the Congressional Black Caucus, which included a non-voting member from the U.S. Virgin Islands, another jurisdiction on the OECD's blacklist, strangely enough, it really, you know, it's incredible to think that George W. Bush, this was shortly after he was elected, it's in the spring of 2001, he was elected at the end of 2000. The narrative that's usually been told about what happened with the U.S. Withdrawing support from the OECD effort was that it was sort of an anti-tax move. And I don't think that's really an adequate explanation, because it wasn't until the spring of 2001 when they changed course and withdrew support from it. And of course, you know, you can see the Trump administration's made this very clear that being anti-tax is not the same as being anti-tax on the foreign operations and foreign activities of Americans. I think that's a different kettle of fish. But what happened then, it was a sense that the OECD had gone on a wrong course. It was engaging in stereotyping, and that's how it came up with a list that included Liberia, but not Switzerland. And the Congressional Black Caucus included folks like Charles Rangel, who had been an anti-apartheid activist and had created a rule on foreign tax credits, incredibly, that was known in some circles as the Rangel Amendment.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit? What exactly
sure.
was that?
So the Rangel Amendment was a change to the foreign tax credit rules that denied foreign tax credits to U.S. businesses operating in South Africa, right? So this was, I don't believe that this is what ended apartheid, but it's incredible that at the time, this was the kind of conversation you might have about tax, that maybe we should not be granting foreign tax credits to U.S. businesses operating in apartheid-era South Africa. So Charles Rangel had been one of the architects of that, often given credit for that. And when I wasn't there, obviously. I was just out of law school. I was working hard at a big firm at the time. I picture the delegate from the U.S. Virgin Islands who first wrote a letter to O'Neill, then sharing that letter with her Congressional Black Caucus colleagues, including Rangel, who would see countries like Liberia on the list. And he was at the time negotiating a free trade agreement with a group of African countries. So he knew, like little old me at the big law firm knew that Liberia was not a threat to our world tax system. He certainly would have known that. And I think for him, it was easy to see that what was going on reflected a really cloistered view of the world that really did not understand the world beyond the lower 48. And for Rangel, he was this American ex guy, a Korean War hero. He was certainly pro-American, but he really had a sense of justice, partly racial justice. That's obviously why he was, bending the tax code to help fight apartheid. You don't do that unless you really mean it. And so his take on and influencing O'Neill and George W. Bush to reject the OECD's effort, now when I see what's happening in the US and I created a stir earlier this year when I wrote an open letter to Biden in The Nation, criticizing the current secretary's effort. So Biden had called out in his announcement of one of his plans that involved the minimum tax, and he called out two countries in that statement. He called out the Caymans and Bermuda. And he, of course, neglected, again, Switzerland. This, of course, reminded me of 2001. Luxembourg and Ireland and the others that the Tax Justice Network says are responsible for more than half of the lost tax revenues that the world suffers every year. The axis of avoidance, the Tax Justice Network calls it. So we're getting that same sort of misleading approach to this effort. And, when I wrote that letter, I didn't think it would have any impact. And I just knew that I had to say something. And I was really delighted when in Biden's State of the Union address, he actually called out Switzerland first. And I like to think that it was, I wish I could have done this in 2000, but I was a little too junior then. And I'm not happy that I got an opportunity to speak out on this same dynamic, but I was happy to see that there was at least an ability to learn, and that between the initial statement and the State of the Union address, the fact that you can't just call out majority Black countries for something that is not a Black-white issue. You can't make it a racial issue as they did intentionally or unintentionally. So I think that I'm pretty old, and John, I'm looking at you on Zoom, so I know you're my age, so this isn't going to be a total surprise to you, that the George W. Bush administration did not have the same fraught relationship with African Americans as, say, the Trump administration did. George W. Bush was not somebody who was, you know, who sort of employed the xenophobic and, you know, anti-Black rhetoric, anti-immigrant rhetoric that Trump might have. He certainly had not given up on the Black community in the way that a lot of contemporary conservatives seem to be doing. So, you know, it was interesting to me to see that that what seems today to be kind of a twist, that you would have the Democrats. Of course, this was the same era in which the Clinton administration got tough on crime in a way that's been blamed for mass incarceration. So the same sort of willingness to be tough in a way that was racially had really complicated racial implications that George W. Bush wasn't willing to do, and you're seeing almost the opposite today. So it's unfortunate, and I think that it reflects a direction the world has taken to, you know, a lot more anger and suspicion and xenophobia than was the case 20 years ago, unfortunately.
Well, you know, while we're sort of on a general topic, so Secretary O'Neill, I read the op-ed yesterday, and what he said was, America has no interest in getting involved with other countries' tax policies. So here we are. That was 2001. We're now in 2021. And, you know, this is, of course, a bit of a paraphrase, but I think we have Secretary Yellen saying, America does have an interest in other countries' tax policies, and we want them to have a minimum tax.
Well, so, you know, I think, you know, my sense is, you know, a little different. But I think that one thing that's interesting about the way the current pillar two seems to work, or what they've agreed to so far, right? So nobody's actually agreed to force other jurisdictions to adopt a minimum tax, right? What we have these days, or right now, is an agreement that if a jurisdiction adopts a minimum tax, the other countries will go along with it, mm-hmm. right? And you know that is, I think, not inconsistent with what O'Neill had said in 20 years ago. So if what the current Pillar 2 actually says is that if the US adopts a minimum tax that is going to collect revenues that really belong to another jurisdiction under the longstanding principles of international tax, other jurisdictions are going to go along with it. I gave a presentation not long ago on treaty resourcing. I don't know, John, whether you've encountered this delightful hall of mirrors, but
resourcing income,
yeah, or the failure to do so under tax treaties. I'm sure some of your contacts in the tax world have suffered at the hands of a failure to resource income under treaties. But it's a really complicated space, and I think you have to look beneath the surface of what the Pillar 2 headlines are saying to see what is actually happening. And I don't think that there is still an appetite for getting involved in what other countries are doing. I think that this is an effort to, this is what I think, you know, Michael Gratz talked about in the domestic context is paint by numbers lawmaking, where, you know, you have to fit within the budget rules. You want to do certain fun things. In order to do them, you have to pay for them with tax increases. And for the last, 10 plus years, the only place that anybody will agree to raise taxes is on people who aren't physically present in the US. I don't know why that seems to be the only place where taxes can be raised. And that's certainly true, but it doesn't seem to be doing much or to help other jurisdictions or to create a level playing field globally. There's some suggestion that they're doing that, but it's not actually happening.
Now, a couple days ago, or maybe it was yesterday, in fact, you had another article appear in the Nation where you're talking about, you know, what I interpret to be, I don't know, sort of a form of aggression against, you know, the sort of dominant members of the OECD against the rest of the world, and sort of trying to
force this stuff. Absolutely.
Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think what, you know, what's the most interesting to me about what's changed between 2000 and today, the OECD has, what it has learned from the experience 2000 and 2001, where the US really gave it a whack on the nose for having taken this really aggressive stance. It's really made an effort to pitch itself as a global community rather than a membership organization. And, you know, some of your listeners know that in 2015, a group of developing countries made an effort to shift the focus of global tax policy making away from the OECD towards the UN, right? So it really would be a more inclusive set of actors. That didn't work because of really active resistance by a lot of developed countries, including the United States. And so things stayed within the OECD. And what we got instead was the OECD's inclusive framework. And you know, there's a really great scholar, a law professor by the name of Shuyi Wei, who I think is currently working on her sociology PhD. So it's interesting you talk about the sociology of tax law. She's really walking the walk. And she showed that a lot of what's happening with the OECD and inclusive framework is not sort of the glass half full narrative we usually hear, that the OECD is leading by example, creating rules that are raising all boats. What she shows through her work is that part of what the OECD is doing is, you know, just, is it short of bullying? I'm not sure if it's quite bullying, but the use of blacklists in order to force poorer countries to embrace the priorities of rich countries is really what she's seeing when she looks at what the inclusive framework is doing. And of course, I see this, I apologize, I don't know if you can hear the sirens that are passing by me in Brooklyn, but that is part of life in Brooklyn. So, you know, we've seen this over time. We've seen that the focus of the OECD's efforts, so, and the US, so the developing world cares more about corporate tax than personal income tax. They get much more of the revenues from that. But from FATCA to the CRS until now, the focus has been on individual income tax, sort of fixing that kind of evasion rather than on corporate income tax avoidance. And that was really a rich country first set of priorities that the OECD and the US has pursued. You know, now we have we get to the corporate chapter, and again, we see that what the OECD is prioritizing is policies that really benefit the rich countries over the poor ones. And you've seen this through statements by organizations like the South Center that have made clear that the developing world's demands, pleas, requests have basically all been ignored, and that the global deal that the OECD is presenting is not really a global deal. It's really a global North deal that the global South is being forced to go along with under threat of blacklisting and other sort of unpleasantness.
Yeah, so I mean, looking at your article yesterday, if I may just read a couple sentences that I think sort of capture that. You know, so it begins by talking about sort of the stability, but it says the stability has preserved a profound inequality, invariably privileging the interests of insiders. Why would it prioritize the interests of some? Because the OECD is and has always been an exclusive club, an organization of elite global players. When designing tax policies, it has always acted for the benefit of its members, the world's richest countries, at the expense of others. Now, on that, you also make the point, and I've seen this point made in two or three different places at least, that consensus is that for poorer countries to grow, they need to be able to tax, 20% of their GDP or whatever. And the as I understand what you're saying is the combined effect of these rules actually prevents them from reaching that threshold.
I think that's right. And I, the point is an obvious one. And I think it's important to say that the result is clear. Under the rules that have been established, although tweaked from time to time, I think the result has been that poor countries are not able to collect enough tax revenues to grow sustainably. So Atiya Warris, a professor at University of Nairobi, documented that across Africa, more than half of the countries collect less than 50% of their total economic output in taxes. As you say, the UN has said 20% is sort of the absolute floor for sustainable development. And I think it is fair to say, and I'll try to be as generous as I can when I say this, that it's not obvious that anybody is designing rules to keep Africa poor. I just don't think that anybody's really thinking about it that hard, but it should be the first sentence in every statement about what we're doing now, mm-hmm. that is not okay, right? That the rules we should be designing now should be designed with urgent priority to fix that.
Now that is what you, I think, referred to on Twitter yesterday and then indicated that that was a view shared by Professor Allison Christians of what you would call the third pillar of all this.
So there have been a few different proposals, and Allison Christians is somebody I've known since the days of practice incredibly. So we follow different paths where we are now, but I think that, we're American-trained lawyers, but we have roots outside the U.S. as well, which I think helps give us a different perspective than a lot of our contemporaries. And so, in her work, I think she's a more creative and patient person than I am. Where I'm just sort of yelling, she's actually offering creative solutions to the problems that we face. And she is trying to work within the system to create a more equitable solution. She's done this in a number of papers, and I really respect her work. I think she's wonderful. And what she suggested with her Pillar 3, her and her co-author Tarcisio tried to create a system that would offer a bigger share of the Pillar 1 revenue stream to poor countries, right? I think that you could get at this a number of different ways, right? So one way that I suggest in that Recent Nation piece is if you think that poor countries need more revenue, perhaps you could simply not prevent them from collecting digital services taxes.
What a revolutionary thought.
It's often presented as, do we need to give them a handout? That might be nice, but before we get to handouts, why don't we just not care whether Zimbabwe imposes a digital services tax? I don't think it's going to destroy Amazon.
In other words, not interfere with their tax sovereignty.
It's remarkable to me that that may be the biggest surprise out of this whole exercise. That not that Professor Christian's Pillar 3 has not been adopted. I think that she's right that it would be helpful and would be productive, but that there's been so much reporting about what the OECD is doing and so little attention being paid to this aspect of it, that these digital services taxes that would, Kenya, Nigeria, for example, still holdouts, I think, on the OECD deal, adopted them. And, Kenya thought that it was going to raise about $45 million each year from this, which is pretty important if you're Kenya, I think. To be able to raise this kind of revenue. I don't think anybody's asked whether, no offense to Professor Christians, I forgive them for not asking whether Pillar 3 should be included in these reports. It's a very technical exercise, although important. But I'm surprised that more journalists haven't simply asked why exactly we're banning these digital services taxes and not allowing any sort of per person or per country exclusion for countries that really badly need the revenue in the middle of a pandemic. Can you imagine banning taxes that these countries have actually been able to impose when they need the money to pay for vaccines and a lot of other things?
Well, I think that, you know, it seems to me that if the OEC didn't have such control over the process, that there might not be such opposition or a vehicle to express such opposition
to these. Well, but it's not fair. Is it fair? I don't know if it's fair to wonder why journalists covering this haven't asked that question. And maybe it's just too darn complicated. But I don't think this is that complicated a question. You know, what's so wrong with these digital services taxes?
Nothing.
You know, why should they be banned? That doesn't seem consistent with the overall goal of making sure these digital giants pay tax anywhere. That seems okay to me. At least not obviously bad.
Well, it seems okay to an awful lot of people, but you know what I've sort of gradually learned, or this has gradually seeped into my consciousness, is how how basically this really has a lot to do with just sort of the logic of violence and power. You know, those who have the power make the rules, they make the rules to benefit them. And, you know, I think one of those interesting books to come out this year, and I know that that you know Dorothy Brown, or, you know, I believe you've done things with her, is Dorothy Brown's, is it called The Whiteness of Wealth?
It is, that's exactly right.
Yeah, so she's a professor at, I believe, Emory Law School, Emory University in Atlanta. You know, an amazing, you know, some of these realizations I think are perhaps just too simple for the average mind, and that's why it takes so long, you know, to understand them. But, you know, if you have a tax code where, I mean, so much good and so much harm can be done in a tax code. I mean, if Russia had a tax code like the United States in 1917, there would have been no need to have executed the Tsars, right? You could have just, you know, done it through some new tax provision or something. But what is very interesting is how clearly she demonstrates that when, you know, various groups are effectively excluded from the legislative process from being, surprise, surprise, you know, their interests are not equally considered. And, you know, I mean, it's amazing to me at whatever we are, 2020, 2021, at this time, to have, you know, her work come out and, you know, your work come out, which is fascinating. And then Professor Lippman, you know, has a long history of writing about, you know, the inequality of taxation on what undocumented aliens or whatever. And it seems to me that in America, but that doesn't mean in the rest of the world too, okay? So I'm not singling it out. I'm just more aware of it here. You know, you've got like 3, 4, 5 different tax systems, right? You know, so the question is, you know, it's like we have a book for minorities. We have a book for Americans abroad. We have a book for undocumented aliens, et cetera. And they all experience this tax code, which, you know, one could, I suppose, argue is written in a neutral way, but the effects are so different from group to group. There's effectively like 5 or 6 different tax codes.
It's really incredible. And, you know, I agree. Dorothy Brown's work, you know, I've known her for years, and she's really incredible. And, you know, one of the remarkable things is getting to know her. And, you know, she's been making these points for years, exact point you make, that there are two tax systems, one for white Americans, one for Black Americans. And I'll let you guess which produces a better result for taxpayers.
I couldn't possibly figure it out.
No, it's a tough one. It's a puzzler. But what one of the reasons she wrote the book that she did was that she grew frustrated with trying to persuade tax people that this was a problem. I think for many tax folks, the idea that you would have, you know, as you say, two different books of laws for different groups did not seem an urgent problem. And she decided that she was going to, you know, appeal to a higher authority, which was the public. And I think the public has pretty resoundingly made clear that this is a problem. That, you know, one example that I don't think she talks about in the book, but that I learned about from another professor, Professor Jeremy Bearer-Friend, currently at GW, that when you look at retirement savings in the US, the way that the, you know, a provision that I thought was just perfectly neutral, you know, race neutral, and everything else, the way 401ks work, because they're designed by and for members of the management class, they provide much better retirement sort of savings for those in management. So they show that researchers have shown that you know, for Blacks and Latinos, the 401k does not work as well because of the kinds of jobs they have. So even adjusting for controlling for wealth and income, Blacks and Latinos have less access to 401ks than white Americans. And this is really a problem, right? Because 401ks are an amazing tool for building wealth. And, you know, I don't think that anybody who designed the 401k had any ill will towards Blacks or Latinos.
It's just that they put these things together based on how they see the world.
Absolutely. And if you have people who are designing the rules that only experience the world in one way, and I know that, you know, you work with a lot of Americans who live overseas, and I think that for a lot of people who make U.S. tax policy, they just can't imagine that as a reality. They don't know what that looks like. And if they are, they're imagining, you know, the year, the summer they spent when they were an associate in London or something.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they're picturing. They don't imagine what it means to live sort of permanently outside the United States.
No, and my mother, as you know, John, is from North Dakota, but has lived in the Bahamas for 50 years now. You know, I know from her perspective what it means to be an expat for many years. And it can be pretty complicated. And I know it's gotten much more complicated over the last few years.
Well, it certainly has. There's no doubt about that. But I mean, one very important example is, you know, with these guilty provisions, you know, as I mentioned earlier, in March and April, watched the Senate Finance Committee hearings, you know, where they're just constantly going on about this guilty issue. I mean, it's like they just can't let go of it, right? But what's amazing to me is that never once in all these hours of discussion about the guilty rules was there any acknowledgement that those rules affect far more individuals than corporations, and of those individuals, that the vast majority are Americans who live outside the United States. So, you know, they're thinking with sort of half a deck, so to speak. I mean, they don't even have the facts they need to make.
Well, it's interesting, and you know, again, it reminds me of 2000 because you know, where the OECD's plan started to unravel. I think they had, and I don't know how much they understood about it, the U.S. political process, but they had included on the list, on the blacklist, the U.S. Virgin Islands. And of course, the U.S. Virgin Islands has not a voting representative, but a non-voting delegate. So I think they were quite comfortable with the idea that they'd be able to include this non-voting territory in the blacklist. But of course, through the Congressional Black Caucus, that delegate had friends who were voting, including Charles Rangel, who was the head of Ways and Means at the time, chair of Ways and Means. So this was, he would not be ignored. And I guess, you know, my suspicion, and I'm curious about your take on this, John, is part of what's making this so easy is that a lot of Americans living overseas don't have that voice in Congress. You know, if there were somebody who could speak to their concerns, the results might not be perfect, but they'd be better.
I think there's absolutely no question about that. I mean, Americans abroad are, I think, politically disenfranchised. I mean, they may have the right to vote, but you know, their votes are so spread out that they don't matter a great, great deal. In fact, you know, going back to, I don't know if you may or may not remember this from law school. I'd forgotten this great quote in the Carolyn Products case until I got more involved in this kind of work, you know, about the discrete and insular minorities who's interest, how did he put it, might be entitled to heightened judicial solicitude or something of that nature. Yeah. I mean, I think that Americans abroad may well be on the level of a discrete menstrual minority. But it's a gigantic problem. And, you know, many of them are basically being forced at this point to renounce their citizenship in order to be able to just participate in normal, you know, financial planning outside the United States.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I think it's unfortunate. You know, as I say, my mom has lived overseas for 50 years, but I know she still considers herself an American.
Well, it's, you know, I think long run, it's a great loss to the country. You know, in Ireland, Ireland takes great pride in its diaspora. There's actually in Dublin, there's a museum of Irish emigration, if you can imagine, Irish immigration, where, you know, there's this huge celebration of all these people who've left Ireland and done amazing things, including, you know, I think that President Reagan was in there, and, you know, et cetera. So it's a completely different attitude. I think that part of the problem is that the American psyche for so many years has been that America is a place that you go to, but you never leave.
Yeah.
Or if you leave, you know, you leave temporarily. I mean, the word expat is, I think, a word used more in America or in relation to Americans than perhaps others, you know, connoting sort of a temporary visit abroad, you know, and then you come back.
Oh, I thought it was worse than that. I thought it suggested a certain kind of disloyalty.
Disloyalty?
Expatriate?
Well, expat.
Can you be an expat?
If you start with expat, I think they're probably okay. Expatriate. Well, I think a lot of people, it's because they spell expatriate, they spell it E-X-P-A-T-R-I-O-T. That's how they think.
Okay. I get it. Okay. I always thought it was almost an accusation, an epithet, rather than a description. You know, you used to be a patriot, but now you're not.
Some people are probably, yes. I think for some, maybe it depends on where you go. Maybe if you were to go to Liberia or somewhere like that, you know, that would, or the Cayman Islands, you know, then you'd be, that would be the ultimate disloyalty. Probably there's certain kind of.
Well, I assure you, when my mom left, so my parents met in the States and lived in Minnesota for a while and moved back to the Bahamas, but I assure you, she was not going back to the Bahamas for tax reasons. She was going for love. So I know there are many reasons to leave the U.S. And, you know, I think the simple stories that people tell themselves about why people do things really do miss a lot of the richness of life.
You know, the American tax code even has negative effects on marriages between U.S. citizens overseas and non-U.S. citizen spouses. It's unbelievable how much, you know, this tax that just permeates the life of American citizens.